It is almost 6 o'clock, and next up is It You or Is It Me with your host Guinevere and her guest. Stay tuned.
Well, hello everyone. This is Guinevere D'Amblia. It is we are at KBOO 97.7 Portland. I have with me tonight Jen Burlton. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you
so much for coming on.
Guinevere, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be invited to join you, and this is no different.
Yeah. So you have come into Is It You or Is It Me? Is our show, and our episode tonight is Truth, Lies, and the Space in Between. Mm-hmm. And we have plenty to talk about that space in between. So, Jen, would you explain a little bit about what it is we're going to start talking about, the disparity between what our experience that we see as truth and the propaganda around it?
Yeah. So specifically in the realm related to gender diverse identity and gender diverse expression, there is this delta that exists between what we know are the fact-based experience through lived experience or through peer-reviewed research or peer-reviewed studies or clinical experience, what the realities are for trans spectrum mm-hmm. folks. And I use trans spectrum with an extremely wide net,
uh-huh.
right? And so gender diversity, all from the most mild forms of gender nonconformity up through trans identity and everything in between or beyond or spherically attached in some way.
Right.
And we're in a time where the concept of fake news is pervasive. And mm-hmm. it's no less pervasive, specifically when we're talking about intentional efforts made to misinform the public, misinform care providers and allies, and specifically and perhaps most insidiously, to specifically misinform parents and caregivers of gender diverse children, the goal being to misinform them enough that they will hesitate in showing support or affirmation for their kiddos, which we know the result of that. And research tells mm-hmm. us the right. result of that is heightened trauma, suicidal ideation, depression, low self-esteem.
But to start with.
But for the other, for those that are the purveyors of this misinformation, their goal is to eventually, the longer they can put off somebody identifying as gender diverse, they believe the more likely that they will never identify as gender diverse, and therefore they won't have to deal with that.
The art of suppression. So before we jump too much into it, you and I were talking just before the show, and our discussion ranged around this. We're using the trans experience, or the transgender idea, because first of all, it's front news these days. there's a lot of this misinformation, this intentional manipulation of words and things that we'll get into. But we also noticed that it's not limited to us as trans people, trans women, trans men, like you said, any part of that spectrum. It is not limited. It is going on now and has been going on with race, with heritage,
immigration,
ethnicities that are other than white.
Right.
I guess we can say that because it seems to be coming from that. So as this discussion goes on, we are having it with this in mind, that this is not just us. We're not sitting here as trans women complaining about something, but bringing up this idea. Jen has a list of words and places it comes from, things that are buzzwords. What do you call them?
Well, trigger words, buzzwords. This is really the coded language.
Coded language.
Of anti-trans hate. And you're right. I mean, we all recognize that when Trump or other entities refer to immigrants as hordes, or invaders.
Mm-hmm.
Those are coded words. Those are buzzwords intended to dehumanize people. We recognize coded words, for example, when a group of people of color gets together to complain, it's a mob. When a group of white people gets together to complain, it's a Eagles Club meeting, you know. So we and just over the years, you know, anybody who cares about social justice and about equity and equality begins to assimilate and recognize what these words are. But the words that are being consistently used to isolate gender diverse folks, and through my work with Transactive Gender Project at Lewis and Clark at the graduate school, and for years before that, our primary focus is on how are we creating societal and community environments that are healthier for gender diverse children of all ages, starting as young as 3 years old, going up to our age of children, being as young and delightful as we are, Guinevere.
Absolutely.
And so, but what we don't recognize is, and what's not pervasively understood, is that the code words used to prejudice or attempt to prejudice people against gender diverse concepts and identities is ingrained. It is used frequently. Mm-hmm. It is repeatedly used. It's used with intent, and its use is coordinated.
You know, that's just scary. You know, it's like, I have felt that. I've read that. I know that. But we tend to kind of gloss it over a little bit. Oh, yeah. It's just a word. But no, the emotional hit, the core hit with these trigger words. And when you think about their intentional and their directive and their planned, is, you know, of concern.
Yeah.
You think? I don't know what to say. It's
history is, where the concern comes from is that we're all capable to one degree or another of reading and understand history.
Uh-huh.
Right, and in virtually every instance where some type of power structure, whether that be based on ethnicity, and you can look at Bosnia-Herzegovina, you can look at Rwanda, you can certainly look at the colonization of the Americas across the board, regardless of what the who the person in or the institution in power is, one of the first things you do to begin to target those that don't measure up, and I'm using air quotes here, those that don't measure up, is first of all, you create a separate language to refer to them. Right? One example is effeminate. Right? So we've got this word feminine, and we have this word masculine. But for male assigned or identified people, if they're in any way feminine, referring to them as feminine simply isn't enough. An extra word had to be invented. It's kind of like flammable, inflammable, or non-flammable. Either it flams or it doesn't flam.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so it's like, well, there's masculine, there's feminine, but then there's effeminate. And effeminate, just the way it sounds, is very much like that's clearly undesirable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Subtle.
Subtle.
Subtle, but impactful.
Subtle and ingrained, right? And so in... the way these words are now being used, specifically in context of discussing gender diverse identities, is clearly identifiable to people like me that have been doing this type of education work, and many, many people, not just me alone. It's like, oh my God, red flag, red flag, red flag. But if you're a parent that is looking for, I just want information about why my kid isn't behaving like my other children or the other kids, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or if you're an adult family member and your sibling or somebody came out to you and you go on the web and you're looking for information, depending on what website you land on, you may see a lot of words that sort of seem like they're supportive, but then there's this slight tinge of it not really being supportive. And how do you know? I can tell you. I have a secret decoder ring here.
Share.
I will. So first of all, this information is consistently coming from a variety of resources.
Mm-hmm.
But these different places are fairly consistent. One of the leading ones is an organization called the American College of Pediatricians. And this may be the single most insidious source of this information, simply because of their name.
Right. Now, this group, the American College of Pediatricians... Now, what you have found, is this really specifically targeted towards trans or gender diversity, or is it a little wider? I haven't really researched them. I've heard what you've said about
them,
and I looked a little bit, and yeah, you can see it easily.
So it is wider than trans and gender diversity. It is essentially a pseudo medical fraternity professional organization that bases its opinions and judgments roughly on concepts related to family morality, family values.
Mm-hmm.
So they're equally anti-gay. They're equally anti-abortion. They're equally, in fact, they were founded. The specific reason they were founded in 2003 was because the American Academy of Pediatrics, and everybody listening, please note, the American Academy of Pediatrics is a legitimate, peer-reviewed, ethical organization that has been in existence since the 1930s with over 70,000 members that are dedicated to serving the best interests of your kids. But the American College of Pediatricians sounds really cool and official too, doesn't it?
It does.
They've got a letterhead.
Buy that one.
Business
right now.
Cards and mm-hmm. everything. So if you
business cards.
So if you don't know, if you're a parent and you don't know the difference between the American Academy of Pediatrics, thumbs up,
right,
or the American College of Pediatricians, thumbs down. By the way, also designated as a hate group by the American Southern Poverty Law Center.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know the difference, you may see literature coming from the American College of Pediatricians that sort of sounds like we really care about your child. But if you know these secret decoder ring words, you can see where the subterfuge is.
Yeah, it's like their care is coming from an entirely different point of view.
Absolutely it is. And some of the others are just the Family Research Council, the American Family Association. We include in our work, we include mentioning the Republican Party. Not all Republicans,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
Republicans actually, some trans people are actually Republicans themselves. And Republicans are raising trans kids in a supportive, encouraging environment. But part of the Republican Party platform is anti-transgender.
Mm-hmm.
So the party itself is engaged in hate, and many other organizations, including media outlets like Fox News. So what are the buzz terms?
Yeah.
What are the code words? So there's one of the newest ones is this completely bogus pseudo-diagnosis called ROGD, or Rapid Onset Gender Dysphoria.
Yeah. I mean... Just hearing that, it's like, you know, whoever came up with that needs a medal or something for the most ridiculous idea ever. It's like rapid onset.
Gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. So it just showed up. You're standing at a bus stop one day, minding your own darn business.
Got your school books there, and all of a sudden,
bam! Oh my God.
I'm trans.
I'm a trans. How did I become a trans? Wow. And so really where this came from was as more and more acceptance of gender diversity has become more and more clear in our society. We're not there yet, folks. Just by me saying this doesn't mean, hey, we got this licked, right? No. But as it's become more and more visible, particularly in more urban areas, what we're seeing is we're seeing some patterns. And one of the patterns that we've seen, and this has been true all along, but it's just that the number of youth doing this, is that we're seeing a pattern where trans masculine teens and youth, so those are people that were assigned female at birth but identify on the masculine end of the spectrum, maybe just masculine as far as characteristics go, but perhaps male identity. We see them coming out and sort of expressing and owning that identity more in the 12, 13, 14, 15 year old range. And some of these oppositional people were like, well, why aren't they telling everybody this when they're 3 or 4? Why aren't we seeing this earlier? Why are they coming out just then? It must be a social contagion. It must be because being trans is so cool. And so they're just coming out all of a sudden like this. And so how could we make that more than just a crazy opinion or a shot in the dark? We'll make up a diagnosis. It's not ingrained, or it's not intrinsic gender identity or gender dysphoria. It's rapid onset gender dysphoria. Fear for your children's lives. And what really gave that a rocket fuel boost was this trans-exclusionary radical feminist, and we can talk about TERFs for short. We can talk about that too. Writer and sort of researcher, again, I'm using air quotes in the studio, wrote this piece that wasn't really ethically peer-reviewed. And the new the Atlantic Magazine Monthly unfortunately accepted her article for publication. This was a couple of years ago. Put it out there, and suddenly it was like, it's officially out there. This is a real diagnosis. And it's just used to de-authenticate kids' identities.
In the end, they pulled it, right? Is that right?
Well, no. The Atlantic published it. It made it to print. In the end, and the person who wrote its name is Lisa Pittman. In the end, what the Atlantic did was they issued a retraction that they were sorry that they had printed the article, that they realized that this research was bogus, that it was not peer reviewed, it wasn't ethical. It was primarily based on interviews with trans-exclusionary radical feminist parents of kids that were gender diverse in some way, and they really weren't happy about it. And so it was debunked pretty much. But it got picked up, and so you'll hear it now on Fox News, and you'll hear it you'll hear it in testimony before Congress, as though this is a real diagnosis now, right? It's a real thing. So that's one of them. I'll go through these others kind of quickly. Another one is the concept of gender confusion. And you can either see that written in print, and it would be framed by quotes. Or if somebody's speaking about it, they will frequently do air quotes when they say that word. And they use the term gender confusion as a alternate word for transgender or gender diversity. And the point is that this isn't just gender diversity. They're confused about their gender. Therefore, we shouldn't respect it. We shouldn't authenticate it. Thinking of gender diversity as an ideology. So in other words, we all got together, had a meeting, decided that we were going to upset the gender role apple cart, and now we're on a mission of some kind.
Well, they decided they were confused.
Well, so, and that's
why
it.
Why don't we say everybody else is confused, not us?
That's right. And we see that a lot with kids, right? So we see a lot when parents don't understand what their child is experiencing. They do this transference, which is that Oh, it's not that uh-huh. I'm confused about what you're saying. You must be confused because you can't adequately explain it to me.
And if you've seen this or heard this in an article or someone speaking, then it's like a click right there. It's like you click into the idea, oh, this must be confusion. It can't be real. It can't be a life experience.
Right.
On any level, it must be confusion because right. you can't possibly be that.
And to put the use of this into context, so for example, you may either see it written something like this in published materials or you may see someone speak, and it would sound something like this. We're all here today because we really care about these kids that some call transgender, and Jen is using air quotes here, you know, and we really want to help them through their gender confusion. So we don't hate the transgenders. We want to help them overcome their confusion. Mm-hmm. And now if you're not sort of a informed, educated, and by educated, I mean educated on this topic, not educated mm-hmm. in general, that doesn't sound really scary, right? I don't hate the transgenders.
The transgenders.
First of all, in and of itself, a dehumanizing. These aren't mm-hmm. people. These are the transgenders. Like, these are the ducks. Mm-hmm.
These are those
quack,
people.
Quack, quack, not college team.
Right.
But, and that's the way that the context is used, right? Other things, always using the word transgender in quotes, in print, or if somebody's speaking about transgender, whether it's on TV or in a public speaking place, always saying transgender in quotes, because quotes implies, you know, it's not real. Mm-hmm. So-called transgender. Transgenderism, if you find articles or people speaking and talking about gender diversity or transgender identity as a belief system, isms more or less tend to be thought of as belief systems.
You know, that word, transgenderism, I mean, that just drives me insane. You know, I mean, it's not even proper.
You may
English.
Not be insane. You may be experiencing rapid onset gender dysphoria.
Maybe that's what it is. Is that what happened? You know, transgenderism, I mean, it's not even proper English. It's not.
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, we have Calvinism. We have Republicanism. You know, we have Zoroasterism, right? We have but these tend, and I'm not mocking those things, but isms tend to be sort of faith-based belief systems. Transgender is not a faith-based movement. Some kind. Quickly, other ones. Uh-huh. Always referring to gender diverse identities or transgender identities as fictitious identities. I'll give you an example that has happened to me. In my work, sometimes I've seen people get wind of training I've done or speaking engagement I've done, and then on some, you know, trying to think of a politically correct way to say really disgusting website. So I'll just say disgusting website. On some disgusting website somewhere, they'll say, well, Jen Burlton, the transgender activist who has the fictitious identity of being a female.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Right? No, I want to let anybody... go ahead.
That's pretty direct.
Oh!
I mean, there's no like... hedging around that.
No, there's not. And for any of those folks that are listening and for other folks that are going, oh, that's terrible, Jen, I'm sorry that you... I'm good. Trust me. You are. I'm good. I'm way past the point where those words or those phrases can hurt me. Not everybody is.
Yeah.
And because of that, we have to stand up for those folks. But trust me, that's just rocket fuel for me. Mm-hmm. That's just rocket fuel for me. So... TERFs, everybody else, you want to call my identity as female fictitious, knock yourselves out doing it. Really. Party on. Mm-hmm. Saying that gender diversity is against biological science. Again, under the assumption they think that because somewhere they learned that there are XX and XY chromosomes, they've decided that that's what God really meant in Genesis. that in the beginning, God created an XY chromosome being and an XX chromosome being, and that's all there is, and that's all there'll ever be.
Case closed. His image.
In his image. So I don't. So I don't know what kind of soft core material God was looking at that out of which crafted the female image, because mm-hmm. he didn't have that image, apparently.
Apparently.
And then quickly, equivalating gender diverse identities to racial or species identity. You know, well, if a kid told you they felt, or if a person told you they felt like they were a dog, mm-hmm. would you authenticate that? Well, if the answer is no, then you shouldn't authenticate a girl telling you she identifies as a boy or vice versa. Equivalence to things like anorexia. This is an argument that they use a lot. And they will use this in printed material and in lecture-based material. They'll give the example. They'll say, if a girl who was 5'10" and weighed 80 pounds came to you and said that she felt overweight, would you agree with her? Well, of course you wouldn't agree with her. So why would you agree if a boy came to you and said he was a girl or said he was non-binary? Would you agree that that was true? It's the same as anorexia, people. And you'd be amazed at the number of people that just go, oh, yeah. Like, yeah, that makes sense. And then just finally, this is an old chestnut that they use. There was a study that came out about 30 years ago now that was, again, based on faulty research mm-hmm. that has since been debunked by a gentleman named Kenneth Zucker. And it came out of a place called the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, Canada. And they came up with this conclusion that they had seen hundreds of gender diverse across the widest possible spectrum of kids in their clinic. And at the end of their research, they came up with a number that they said, well, 90% of the kids that were gender diverse in our clinic no longer identified as gender, and actually they use the word gender nonconforming, not gender diverse. 90% of the kids in our clinic that were gender nonconforming no longer presented as gender nonconforming by the time they left our clinic. Ergo, we come to the conclusion that 90% of transgender kids will no longer identify as transgender because they conflated mere nonconforming to gender expression stereotypes to gender identity. And they lumped the group together and they made a blanket statement that 90% of the kids. Well, of course, if you go to a clinic that disapproves of gender diversity and you spend years there getting it hammered into you that not conforming to gender stereotypes is a bad thing and it makes mommy and daddy unhappy,
right,
then of course you're going to stop doing that. But it doesn't say anything about ingrained transgender identity,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, the art of suppression. I like that. Going to a clinic that doesn't support gender identity, gender diversity, and their result is exactly what their clinic's set up to do. It's like, well, duh.
Talk about research bias, inherent bias, right? Hey, we want to find that these kids don't believe this anymore. Guess what we found out? These kids don't believe this anymore. What are the odds?
And therefore,
you should not affirm gender diversity, because if you just wait long enough, just wait through the whole depression mm-hmm. and the suicidal ideations and all, eventually, you know, if they survive,
mm-hmm.
we're telling you it's probably going to go away, and then you don't have to stretch yourself.
Right.
You don't have to stretch yourself to an understanding of something that's really an inconvenience for you, right? And so that's basically it. That's basically those are the buzzwords. There are a few more, but literally, I promise the listeners, I promise anybody that if you read articles that are anti-trans, they will contain those buzzwords.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your key.
I was looking online for transgender propaganda earlier today, and you know, I saw almost every single one of those in these various articles, and you know, it's just amazing. We were also talking about the intention here. One thing, somebody who's what should we say, not intentionally trying to create an ideal, an ideology, but somebody who's just writing something, as opposed to somebody or a group of somebodies who have an intention to move an opinion, a public opinion, in a direction.
Yeah, so these aren't just words that people that have a different opinion use.
Mm-hmm.
You know how we've heard for many, many years about the gay agenda?
Mm-hmm.
And those of us that have intersecting identities. You outed me as trans. Thank you very much. On the radio before. That's a joke. I am so out as trans.
Oh, I didn't know.
No, you didn't know I was out as trans?
Oh, my gosh.
No. Oh, no. No, when people ask me, you know, do you identify as a patriot or as a resistor, I say, I'm trans. Figure it out. But you decide which side you think most speaks to me.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't just a matter of the people with a different opinion or that are uncomfortable with gender diversity and they all use the same words. This is literally an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
There are these groups, the Republican Party, American College of Pediatricians, Family Research Council, Fox News, religious organizations, the Southern Baptist Convention. These people have all gotten together.
Whoa.
Yeah. These people have all gotten together and they have their talking points.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're going to do. This is our agenda. What is our agenda? Our agenda is to make it so difficult to be gender diverse in this culture that y'all, and I'm including myself in that y'all transes,
y'all trans,
are going to make the choice to not be visible. And if you're not visible, you don't exist. And if you don't exist, then we can tell whatever lies we want to about you. We can position hate against you in a way we want to. And literally, we can eliminate you if we want to.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've seen that done before.
So let's back this up a little bit and unpack the idea that they've all got together. Because I do have a conspiratist identity, like everything's a conspiracy, right?
Right.
All these people have somehow had a meeting. But let's unpack that a bit. Like, in get together, in your idea or your experience, your knowledge, what does that mean? I mean, I know it could mean, yes, seriously, yeah. They flew into a town and had a meeting. But it seems a little far-fetched, but...
Well, and I don't. In some cases, they did fly into towns and have coordinated meetings. Some of those meetings were organized by elected officials. Some of those meetings were organized by religious people that they invited elected officials to.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, I just want to address the kind of framework of it being a conspiracy theory or an aspect of a conspiracy theory, really, really quickly, just for a second.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's important because you know the other buzzwords are...
Right, right. So first of all, there clearly was a coordinated effort to get marriage equality passed. That wasn't a conspiracy theory. When they used...
To get it passed?
To get it passed, to make marriage equality the law of the land. When they said it was a gay agenda, the implication was that all of us gays were sort of like on the same page and doing all this. But no, clearly the Human Rights Campaign and Gay and Lesbian GLAAD and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and Lambda Legal, these folks all coordinated. How are we best going to move this conversation forward?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where do we need to win cases in the courts? How do we make our points on television? When our spokespersons go on there, what are the things we want to emphasize? What are we don't? That's the point of talking points. So I'm not pretending that was a conspiracy theory, or was that just a coordinated effort towards justice? The civil rights movement, was that a conspiracy theory, or was that a coordinated effort by multiple different organizations to eliminate Jim Crow? Right? So something doesn't have to be a conspiracy theory and to be a coordinated effort. The real question is, what is the goal of the coordinated effort. Mm-hmm. Is the coordinated effort to expand equality and justice and human rights? Or is the coordinated effort intended to marginalize human beings, dehumanize human beings, put human beings in easily managed boxes which can then be disappeared? I would say that, yeah, they're both, if you want to call it a conspiracy theory, it's interesting. It's only the things that the power structure doesn't approve of that end up being conspiracy theories. Everything else is just conscientious planning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? We've talked about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
To quote.
So there literally was a assessment done. We've lost the marriage equality battle. The public knows too many gay people. And well, so they were all okay with it, and they're all behind the Supreme Court thing, and we're on the fringes of that now. But majority of people don't know the trans people, so we can create a narrative about who they are.
And put our energies that way. So let's talk about agendas and intention for a moment. You just said about the Marriage Equality Act and people getting together. What was the intention behind that movement, and what's the intention behind the opposition to that movement, or now it's transgender? You know, I mean, on the surface, I get it. There's some people who think it's not right, or they're offended, or maybe they're in the closet and they have to do this to protect their identities.
Or they think their religion or their deity actually speaks to them and tells them that this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so how do we look at that? You know, there's plenty of opposition around the world from different cultures and things like that. There's how do you think that as a society, as a group, we take that kind of intention and work with it and deal with it? I mean, really, seriously, somebody thinks they're God is coming down and saying this is right, wrong, or they're looking at a 2,000-year-old book where it doesn't really apply anymore.
In many ways, for some people it does, and I completely respect people of faith that for whom they get strength and guidance from that. This isn't about any particular religion being defective or having ill intent. All religions are interpreted by people that have varying levels of power, and they get their power from the way that they interpret these books that speak the words of their deity or their prophet. And so God isn't getting that Learjet that Billy Graham Jr.'s, what's his name? Franklin Graham. Is flying. Mm-hmm. God doesn't have a first class seat in that jet. Franklin Graham has a first class seat in that jet, right? Because Franklin Graham is getting people that want to sort of give up their capacity to cognitively think and evaluate and assess and think for themselves to his interpretation of God's words. I mean, I think God should sue the son of a gun for plagiarism. For plagiarism. Mm-hmm. I didn't say it.
No, you didn't.
I was going to say bobblehead. Just
bobblehead,
so you know.
Right.
I was going to sue the bobblehead.
Mm-hmm.
So here's unfortunately the conclusion I came to, and it's not the path that I'm following. And it's not the kumbaya answer that people want. I don't think that a lot of people want. I believe that people that are firmly ingrained because they believe they're channeling a message about innate universal morality or something like that, I don't believe they're movable on this issue. Let me clarify that. There's only one thing that can move somebody from that, and it isn't any argument. It's when a transgender child or person in their own family
walks in the door.
Grandpa. That's right. And then it goes from being sort of this theoretical analysis of or framing of who these people are to like, well, you know, they said that they were all evil sex monsters, but this is Cousin Billy, and we like Cousin Billy, and Cousin Billy isn't like that. And so then maybe you begin to question, right?
Well, then you have three pathways. You have non-acceptance. You have just neutrality.
Or tolerance.
Tolerance.
I think of neutrality as tolerance is kind of neutrality.
Yeah.
We're going to put up with it. We're not crazy about it, but, you know, we're going to put up with it.
Yeah, and you never really connect with the child after that. Or you have full acceptance, which would involve probably some personal work in what you were just talking about, which is your belief system.
Yeah. And I like to use the word affirmation even more than acceptance, because I think it's really important. I think there are people that in and of themselves, they may still struggle with accepting that your truth mm-hmm. is as deeply felt as I experience my truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I really need them to ever get to that sort of awareness point where they understand that your truth is as deeply felt as mine. But what I do need, and I think what we need as culture, is for them to say, whether I do get to that point or not, I affirm the authenticity of your life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I will do nothing and should do nothing to stand in the way of you pursuing your truth. And I think that's a little bit different from acceptance.
Acceptance, you're right. Yeah, acceptance is a bit vanilla in some way. Yeah, yeah. So we have
this is interesting radio. We'll just do that for
it
a
is,
while,
right? Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, so we have that kind of that religious point of view. What if it's more lower level than that? I mean, you know, you can
mean lower than God.
Lower level, yeah, lower than God, lower than a belief system that's there, you know, pretty much like scraping the barrel,
right?
Of hate, you know,
right.
People that have a belief system don't necessarily have hate, they have a belief system,
right?
Then again, the low end of that is people whose intentions are to disrupt, spread hate, and you know, right. Just for some really mean, unconscious kind of action, go out and...
Well, it's all about power. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah. It's all about power. I mean, the foundation of anti-trans attitude or homophobia is misogyny. I mean, that's the foundational prejudice. Right. The foundational prejudice is that we should be able to easily identify males and masculinity from females and femininity, because now we've got our two separate groups and we can apportion privilege and rights and power to them. Clearly, this group gets less, this group gets more. And as soon as anybody suggests, you know, that's not a black and white. Human beings don't come in only those two flavors. Then as soon as you add gray area into identity, then the power structure, the apportionment of power, becomes exponentially more difficult.
Mm-hmm. And risky.
Right. You can either be a patriot or a communist.
Yeah, right.
Right? You can't be something in between. You know, socialism, it doesn't really exist. It's commie light, right?
Commie light.
So the hate comes from there. The white supremacy certainly comes from the power structure.
Mm-hmm.
Rights and power is like pie. It's not like pie, but they think it's like pie. If you get more, I have less.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I want people that look like me, sound like me, believe like me to get more pie than you have. And we're willing to kill people in order to keep our piece of the pie. Right, without any rational thought to it, without there's no analysis here.
So the idea of this, the power base, I mean, you know, we've seen that over the eons, the centuries and centuries of masculine power, let's just say. And so we come up, we're just talking about this kind of this lower level upset around a trans identity or gender diverse identity. And that level of hate, it's like, it's a mystery to me of how people can go that deep into an emotion, a human condition, without it coming back into their self-identification, into it feels like it even has to be more than just indoctrinated beliefs. To go into that level, what is a person thinking or feeling or experiencing that their reactive substance is to lash out and do that? It's like it has to be more than just the idea of one-upmanship or power, place in the world.
Well, I mean, that's really the baseline question. I mean, I think most of the world is made up of a couple of different sort of motives. Half of the world is trying to figure out why the other half of the world hates them so much. Mm-hmm. And you can subdivide that into however many different groups you need to do.
Sure.
But not only why do you hate me, how are you capable of sort of not imploding with that much visceral hate? Because I don't know what it feels like to hate somebody that much. I know what it feels like to dislike people.
Sure.
Right? And I'm speaking in general terms now. Just to keep it 100 here, right? I mean, I know what it's like to hate. Right?
Yeah, I know what it looks like, yeah.
Oh, I know what it feels like. I'm going to own that. I'm not going to pretend that I'm immune to that. People that harm children, I hate them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nazis, I hate them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to own that. I've seen what they do. I've seen what that ideology leads to. It is worthy of my hate.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't let that hate control me. But I think hate is every bit as powerful as love. And I'm sorry, Marianne Williamson, I disagree. And so if we're asking this question, then I have to ask, well, how can I love something so much? How can I love my partner, who I've been dealing with for 36 years, so unquestionably and so deeply and so much that there was literally nothing I wouldn't do for her? Mm-hmm. How can I love the trans kids that I've worked with and their families so much that I would throw myself in front of a bus for them? Is that too much love? Is that, is that become self-destructive? If you throw yourself in front of a bus, maybe it's a self-destructive love. So if we can't answer that question, then I don't think we can answer the question of how can people hate so deeply that it consumes them? And I realize we're not really doing a kumbaya moment here, so I'm most of the time I try to be Aunt Fluffy, but right now I'm not really Aunt Fluffy. We're in a time when sometimes we can't afford to be Aunt Fluffy. I think that out of sheer survival, we have to not spend too much time wondering why that person with a baseball bat or with a legislative pen hates us so much that they're willing to either hit us with that bat or create a law or a situation. This goes to, abortion rights, choice.
And on down the line.
Gee, I'm too good a person to authenticate that type of hate is real. I must just continue to educate them. I think that's how people get killed. Nobody believed that the Nazis' hate was so pervasive and so deep and so institutionalized that they could, let alone would, that they could do what they did. Right. And it was only the reality in the aftermath where we said, oh my God, maybe we should have taken them seriously sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And be on the lookout for that kind of movement, which at times feels like it's present. today.
It does. I mean, talking about motivations, I don't for a minute, I think there are a few politicians mm-hmm. that actually do share some of these kind of radical family values, moralistic, your kind is not wanted here. I think they ingrain that stuff. I think Steve King is an example of that. Right. Just the most first one that came to my mind right now, I mean, clearly.
He's kind of been out on top of it.
But I think for most of these politicians, and this includes the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania, I think most of them, it's about my morals and my beliefs are for sale to your morals or beliefs in exchange for you supporting me.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. not, I mean, all these policies that the not allowing trans people to serve in the military anymore, that wasn't Trump's idea.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the military's idea. Shortly after election and before election, he had meetings with some of those groups I named before, American College of Pediatricians, Family Research Council, Alliance Defending Freedom, Pacific Justice Institute. And they came to the Oval Office and they said, you know, Mr. President, I choke even just saying that word. Sometimes I prefer not to use those two, that concept. And they came and said, you know, in exchange for our support, we really turned them out for you. We need you to get the transgenders out of the military because that offends your base. Okay, sure. I'll shoot off a tweet. Transgenders shouldn't be in the military.
Ba-boom.
Ba-boom, right? It's not because they had a... certain people will do anything for power.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know.
Well, it.
Go ahead.
It. In contrast to this idea, I just got back from a 2-week sacred sites tour in Cornwall, and we went to quite a few ancient sites that had been built over by the Roman Catholic Church and other churches. And sometimes these buildings were huge, huge cathedrals, and other times they were just smaller stone structures, but mm-hmm. nonetheless they were developed and put into a box. Some of the sites we saw were off the beaten path, and they were still used by some of the Druid community and other folks.
Celtic traditionalist revivals and things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not even revivals, like some of the really old kept ceremonies mm-hmm. done in just a few places. We got to see these and feel these and go in and touch the rocks and be in the circles and do all of this. And interestingly enough, the end of our trip was in Glastonbury, and one of my most powerful experiences was in the small chapel of Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling I got was that, you know, this is all so superficial and temporary. Overlook the idea that all these buildings have been built over sacred sites and things that are sacred, that it will change. Everything changes. People put up new things, but that as that goddess spirit is the same and won't change. So coming from that place of feeling that, and then during our discussion, feeling the idea of these groups and these intentions and these words and what we need to look out for is, a stretch back into reality, this reality of what people do to each other and why they do it. And it has to come down to power. I mean, I heard you say that several times, but in my experience right here, right now, after having that experience that was so light and full of love, which was endless. I mean, when you say rock in front of, you know, jump in front of a bus or do anything for it, it's like, sure. You know, it's that expansion into a space that's from a caring point of view, from a total acceptance, a total, I would do anything. In, you know, so the contrast between the two is just amazing to me. Mm-hmm. That as a species, this is where we are stuck. Which brings to my mind the importance of what you said was education and bringing this kind of information and having people consider what's been said here tonight, and go out and read some stuff and go out and look at some articles and find your own truth in that.
Apply a critical lens to what is coming past your sensory intake ports.
So we're kind of running out of time. I wanted to ask you how your project is going at the college, because that was a big change, and we have 2 minutes.
It was a big change. So Transactive operated for 12 years as an independent nonprofit. We were the first organization in the country that was founded specifically to do advocacy, education, support, equity work, specifically around gender diversity in children and youth. And in the early part, in February of this year, we completed our transition to become part of the Graduate School of Education at Lewis and Clark. We're part of the Center for Community Engagement there. And this has really...
So awesome.
It's incredibly awesome. And it really fulfilled my vision of getting us to the point where we could have a bigger voice on a bigger stage.
Mm-hmm.
Sad as it is to say, I think we earned a lot of credibility over the years. But amazingly, being at a major liberal arts college expanded that credibility. Now it's just not, you know, Jen Burlton, that trans advocate. I'm not devaluing that, but I'm saying that sarcastically, right? It's like, hey, somebody from Lewis and Clark is on the phone, right? And I work with an amazing team there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, an amazing team. Kelly and Marissa and Krista and Jordan and Matsya. That's a shout out to them.
Right on.
They're amazing and really doing incredible work. We're serving a lot of families, and we're providing a lot of education, because the only thing that eventually overcomes hate and fear is informing enough people that what that is not productive. Here's how you identify it. And by identifying it and being aware of it, you eventually defeat it.
Sweet. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the space in between. Thank you, Jen, so much for coming on. Thank you, Soumya, our beautiful board operator. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog for Lunch in Portland. Unity features artists Maria Advertencia Lirica from Oaxaca, Valentina Peralta from Chile, Portland's Kayla J, and DJ La Pausi. This event is also sponsored by Colectivo Ruda and Cup Hub Creative. Again, la mula no era arisca, pero la hicieron. That's Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog Fair Lounge, 830 E. Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right